When we think about consumption, it seems almost in the American DNA. After all, the very Thanksgiving holiday from which you are hopefully recovering was founded on an act of consuming, celebrating the ability to do so, to stick it out for a little longer. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of November 28th, 2014. This week, our show is about consumption. Not just the feeling that you maybe overate this weekend, but also the gifts we buy and the frenzied effects they can have on us, the music we listen to, even how we see and consume the news and how that, in turn, shapes our conversations. We like to stay in conversation with you, so come share your stories and feedback with us at marketplaceweekend.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. And we're going to start with that idea of conversation. If you've consumed media this week, listened, read, or watched the news, no doubt you followed the events in Ferguson, Missouri, where a grand jury declined to indict police officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of teenager Michael Brown. The protests that followed that decision and rippled out across the country also tell a story about how we consume and communicate the news today. The Ferguson story was first told on social media, and those same social networks have been a powerful tool, both for sharing information and for not sharing it. We invited Zeynep Tufekci to talk about those contradictions. She's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina and a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She points to social media's role in spreading the story.
So if you look at the Twitter streams of people discussing Ferguson, if you look at some of the analyses, millions of tweets were sent in August when the incident first happened and the first protest started, before network news picked it up. Now that we are consuming our news through social media more than before, what I'm noticing is there are these new filters that have come up, and some of them are controlled by companies like Facebook, which you might not think of as a media company, or Twitter, which you might not think of as a media company, but they both are very important gatekeepers. In the case of Twitter, it's what you choose. It's chronological. It makes it hard to use. In the case of Facebook, what I had noticed in August was that it was filtering out Ferguson news on my news feed. Instead, I was seeing a lot of Ice Bucket Challenge, which was popular then, which was fascinating because it was this new kind of editorial control. It was as if NPR or CNN editorially had decided not to cover something. Except in this case, it was Facebook's algorithm.
In a traditional media environment, a newspaper or a TV network would say, here are the stories that we think are important. Here's your meat, here's your vegetables, here's a little bit of dessert for you. Do you worry at all when you study different methods of media consumption that it could be all dessert or all vegetables and people can choose to silo themselves?
We have research showing now that people, yes, they're kind of siloing themselves, but worse, as they see what the people on their social networks think, they're starting not to necessarily share their political views because they think it'll lead to conflict. It's kind of like a Thanksgiving dinner where you just decide you're not going to bring up Ferguson with your uncle, you know?
Right, you don't want to fight with that end of the table.
Right, so even when you're encountering diversity of opinions, it doesn't necessarily create this push to engage each other. And that, I think, is the big question, because if you want to seek an argument, it's probably never been easier in history.
In the aftermath of Ferguson, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, a breakdown in understanding between different communities, different races here in the U.S. To what extent do you see that play out on the web or in social media feeds? And when there is a dialogue centering on one event or one hashtag, do we see a separation?
What I'm hearing a lot is not only people not having deep discussions about it, they're separating their networks in response to what other people are saying. So if they encounter a relative or a friend who disagrees with them, people are choosing to sever their networks. Now, that's a human response. That's understandable. You know, you're upset.
Just to not talk, just to sort of say, yes. I'm going to go over here.
Yes, there's been a lot of that going on, and a lot of people supporting each other in their existing views. I don't really see a lot of conversations among disagreeing groups. On the other hand, and sort of to balance out what I said, if you look at the recent research on what young people think about race and the criminal justice system, there's been a great shift in the past year among younger people that the criminal justice system is unfair to black people. In a year where the Trayvon Martin shooting and the Michael Brown case got a lot of attention. So it's clear that a segment that might not have been exposed to a particular point of view is seeing this. Given the importance of the issue, it's unfortunate that we haven't fostered tools that allow this new connectivity to turn into a real conversation and real understanding rather than a way where you sort of see other points of view, but don't necessarily find yourself trying to hash out an understanding.
Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of North Carolina. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
One of the other big stories in the news, and of course big areas of consumption, is Cyber Monday, the online equivalent of Black Friday. Here to explain it to us is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life, Ben Johnson. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So, Cyber Monday coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Some online shopping. We are talking about security. Should I worry? Should we all worry about our online purchases this year?
Well, the good news is a lot of the fraud we see in retail is actually in person, not online.
That's the good news?
That's the good news. Huge breaches have been brick and mortar breaches like Target and some of these other retailers. You still have to be wary, though, of more focused hacking on Cyber Monday.
So how does that manifest itself?
Okay, so hackers might take advantage of special sales and set up fake websites. They might set up phishing schemes for your email, make you click on a link, and they'll try to lure people into traps. So a good rule of thumb for us, if it's too good to believe, it's probably not true, right?
Okay.
So that's a little tough on Cyber Monday because you're going to be seeing a lot of super sweet deals, right? But there are some things you can do. So you can check the URLs that you go to look at deals or
that's
buy
the address
something.
Across the top for
exactly.
Those of us Luddites.
Yes, in the browser in the top little window there where it says www.target.com, whatever. And you want to make sure they match where you think you're going. So
okay.
If you think you're going to Target and you go somewhere else, that might be something you want to look out for. Some people use password managers to help with this sort of thing. If the password manager, for instance, doesn't recognize a website, it won't log you in. And you can find those in the App Store or the Google Play Store. If you come across a new website offering a great deal, maybe do a little research to see if it's legit.
So how do you figure that out?
Well, there are some things to look for. So for one, I like to think about it this way. Look for the locks and the S's.
Okay.
So if we're talking about that top little window in your browser, there should be a little padlock there telling you that the website is secure, right? If you're going to be making a purchase. And web pages where you're putting in sensitive information will start like HTTPS or HTTPS, not just HTTP. So if you're putting in credit card info on that kind of page without an S, you might be in trouble.
So you can kind of think S for secure.
Yes, exactly. And you can also put the website into whois.net. It's another website that gives you some more context on the websites you're looking at. If you want to be super cautious, buy some prepaid gift cards at a pharmacy or something so that you're not inputting your credit card info. But also remember, credit cards are in some ways better than debit cards because they have better fraud protections and you have longer to flag charges on your card bill that don't seem legit.
Any other privacy tips that I should keep in mind as probably the champion office online shopper?
Well, this is less of a security tip and more about, you know, keeping my present a surprise that you're going to buy me.
Sure.
If you're shopping for gifts and you want to keep what you're buying a secret, you may want to use incognito mode. That's what it's called in Chrome, or private browsing. That's what it's called in Firefox. All the major browsers have these kinds of options, and they make it so that you're not tracked by the same amount of cookies and these advertisements that would pop up when I come into your office and say, hello, I can maybe tell that you've bought me a Lamborghini because you'll be seeing an ad for a Lamborghini
in the browser. You are really trying, man.
Overall, even though people are concerned about their cards after these major breaches, something to remember, the biggest security problems haven't been online. So we're more likely to hear about a Black Friday breach than a Cyber Monday breach. Hmm. And that's because e-commerce has really invested in online security in ways that some of these older brick and mortar stores haven't. And that's actually what we saw with the Target breach. These things were happening, these card swiper copiers were happening in the brick and mortar stores, and that's actually less common online.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You can get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app. You can get it from the iTunes Store or on Google Play. Chances are you consumed a lot of food this Thanksgiving week. In thinking about consumption, we're looking at the growing market for insects to eat. No, stay with me here. They are a cheap source of dense protein, popular in many parts of the world, and now in the U.S. you can get insect flour and insect protein bars. To learn more about the industry, we reached out to Andrew Brentano. He's the co-founder of Tiny Farms, based in Oakland, California. He told me what it's like inside a cricket farm.
It's going to smell like you walk into a barn, basically, where there are cows or pigs or horses or chickens. Like any other animal, they smell like animals when you have a lot of them together. It's going to be reasonably loud because part of your population is going to be adults and breeding, so they'll be chirping away. And whenever you come near a bin, there's going to be a lot of scuttering noise. Crickets actually require a very dry atmosphere, so it's going to be hot and dry and smelly and skittering noises all over the place.
What are the environmental costs of farming insects as opposed to, say, poultry or cattle?
There's this really incredible divide in the resources required for insects versus traditional livestock. Some of the really biggest gains are in water. It takes literally thousands and thousands of gallons of water to raise a cow. And so we're talking hundreds to thousands of gallons of water per pound of beef, for instance. And it takes only about a gallon of water to raise a pound of crickets. We've got big gains in feeding them, big gains in processing them, and also big gains in the feed conversion. So the amount of water that goes into raising a cow, a lot of that goes to watering the plants that it eats. A huge percentage of the world's grain production is actually destined for animal feed, not human feed.
So there are a lot of great arguments, seemingly economically and health-wise, for crickets, but there are so many hurdles to make it work? I mean, are you guys profitable?
No, I don't think anyone in the industry is currently profitable, but there have only been products on the shelf for at most a year. I think there's, you know, I'm not going to say that insects will be the number one driver of our economy, although it could be, but this is such an early stage. In just the next couple of years, there's going to be a rapidly growing market. The market was currently estimated to be market size about $20 million, and it's just sort of on an exponential growth curve right now.
What has to happen then to get this beyond kind of a novelty fascination product to something that people just go, oh, yeah, okay, insect protein?
The real breaking point that's going to make this into a mainstream commodity is going to be bringing the price down to equal or better than current animal protein sources. And we think this is very achievable in the next couple of years, but we're going to have to bring the price of raw cricket down to below, say, $2 a pound. And right now, the very cheapest you can get raw crickets in a very small supply is about $4, $4.50 a pound. That doesn't seem like too far to drop, but it is a pretty significant decrease.
Andrew Brentano from Tiny Farms, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. It was a pleasure.
Admittedly, scuttling noises don't sound super appetizing, but hey, you never know unless you try. So for brunch this week, we went to the Black Ant in New York's East Village. Chef Mario Hernandez serves grasshopper tacos, ant and worm-salted drinks, and more.
We incorporate the insects in our menu because it's the primal source of protein in the antique Mexico. So, for example, we have a really rustic and simple guacamole with grasshoppers from the central valleys of Oaxaca and some ant salt, which is those guys.
Okay. Oh, so those are ants?
Those are ants. Those are
They're really big ants.
Yeah, those are the bellies that we're using to make our salt.
Okay.
We have our chapulines, the grasshoppers. And what we do is we soak it in salty water, then we toast it with some chilies, garlic, lime juice, and we let them dry in the sun.
The chilies is why they have that sort of reddish color? Or?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
And actually, when you cook it, they turn red like the lobster or like the shrimps. It's a little more red because we add some more chilies.
Why did you start cooking with insects?
It's a really important part of the Mexican gastronomy. And it's really important for Mexican people. I mean, the chapulines, you can go to the market and don't have it. It's like a little snack. But right now, it's like a fashion thing. Everybody tries to get them.
All right, let's do it. God, this guacamole is beautiful.
Thank you.
So that goes in there, the queso fresco, everything goes in there?
Yeah, we have some really nice pasilla chili.
Okay. All right, going for it.
How does it taste like?
Good. I'm kind of smoky.
It's a lot of the different textures on the plate.
The grasshoppers are crunchy.
Yeah,
they're very crunchy. They're really good.
Thank you.
What should I try next?
This is our mole.
So we just go straight mole on the
straight
tortilla?
Straight mole on the tortilla. Okay. It's made out of 28 ingredients. One of them is the...
One of them is ants?
The ants, the chicatanas.
It's kind of nutty.
Yeah, and you can wash it with our Yonkax cocktail, which Maxon is going to explain you what it is.
It has fresh corn juice, a splash of fresh pineapple, fresh lemon juice, a touch of agave nectar. We put pitiona leaf, which is a Mexican wild herb, and the rim is made with warm salt, and we top it off with a touch of pitiona as a bouquet for the garnish.
Wow.
It's really good.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this mole tastes, you know, fairly like a traditional mole. I mean, I can taste the chocolate. So that sort of extra bit of...
That bitterness at the end is the...
That's the ant.
Yeah. And this is our crema de chapulín.
Oh, okay.
The chapulín bisque.
Explain to me how you make this one.
Well, it's a soup based on potatoes, apples, grasshoppers, garlic.
Mm, that's really good.
Thank you.
It does kind of have a mushroomy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the closest analogy I could draw.
I think it's because the chapulines has all the earthiness.
The earthiness, yeah.
Yeah, all the flavors from the fields.
Are ants and grasshoppers the only two insects you cook with here?
No, we also have some agave worms. By the end of the month, we're going to have some escamoles, which are the ants' eggs. We change our insects according to the season.
Could you see a future where more people are more comfortable eating insects and different types of protein?
If you take a look, every country has their own insects. I mean, in Asia, it's a lot of insects to eat, and Latin America, too. I think we're going to see in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different places, maybe in supermarkets. That's what I'm thinking.
Mario Hernandez, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having us.
And thank you for this incredible meal.
Thank you.
Someone is probably going to try to sell you music this holiday season, and I want you to think about how you consume it now and how much that's changed over the past decade. Right now, the most valuable consumers, young people, get their music on YouTube, Spotify, and other streaming sites. But one of the most interesting things about this new model is how its breakout stars are launched, not in a little club or underground music show, but online, singing into a webcam and uploading that video to YouTube, and hoping someone like Daniel Rosen spots them and makes them a star. Rosen is a senior talent manager for Fullscreen. His company manages artists and their YouTube and Vine networks, takes them on tour, and makes them money, doing deals with brands like this one.
A recent example of a great brand opportunity we just did is with Sour Patch Kids. We had a brand, Sour Patch Kids, that really wanted to find a way to target a younger demographic. So we actually created an entire web series where we integrated Sour Patch Kids, the candy, into the web series and used several of our top influencers and created an entire show about high school life, the kind of sweet and sour moments.
And where does that air?
That particular campaign lived across multiple platforms. So it actually lived on all of the influencers who participated, all their channels.
Their YouTube channels?
Exactly. It also lived on their Twitter and Instagram accounts as well. But really, Twitter and Instagram drove to the main content, which was video.
And the reason that big companies and brands love companies like yours is that you reach teenagers, you reach young adults, because what, they're looking at their smartphones all the time?
Exactly. Actually, a very large percentage of our demographic is mobile. But I think what it really is it speaks to kind of the new realities of this new digital landscape that we live in. So a lot of our influencers, I think a lot of people over the age of 25 may have actually never heard of them. But if you ask your children if they've heard of them, the answer is unequivocally yes. Go to a high school, every single person is watching YouTube. They're all on Vine, and all of these people are watching and paying attention to the content that our influencers are creating.
I'm fascinated by how somebody becomes a YouTube star. How does that work?
If it was literally just taking a photo or a video of yourself and throwing up online, then everyone would be a Vine star or a YouTube star, but it's not. They spend a lot of time thinking of really creative ideas. They connect with each other. Collaboration is a really important way that creators grow their audiences on YouTube. But it's also really the content and really the ability of these creators to connect with their audiences. I think teens today really want to feel like they're a part of the experience that these YouTubers or these Vine stars are going through. And the creators themselves really get that, and they make it very much a participatory experience.
I'm trying to think about how I would explain your business to, say, my father. It would be like as if he worked for Berry Gordy and he was out scouting young singers in, what, a really small club somewhere, just digitally?
But a really big club, actually, which is the really cool thing. The pool of talent is really endless. I think in the past, if you were an A&R at a record label or a talent manager or an agent at a big talent agency, you would go to small clubs and there was a limited number of slots and you probably only went to the venues where you were living in New York or Nashville or Los Angeles. But today, It's anywhere. You, wherever you are, from the comfort of your own home, can become a real star, and we can find you and help you grow. And that's the most amazing thing about working in the digital space.
How do these kids make money?
For most of them, YouTube is a major source of income. YouTube and Fullscreen basically will sell media against their channel. So you may see ads on YouTube. That's actually part of that money is going to the influencers. But increasingly, a lot of these opportunities are coming off platform. So brand deals, which we've talked about, are a major source of income for a lot of our top creators. But, you know, quite frankly, for some of the biggest stars, it can be really anything. Some people have been in movies. Some have received book deals. They can be traded just as any major star from a traditional world.
You guys just did a live tour, right?
We did a live tour called Intour, which I actually produced. And that's another way that a lot of creators are making money on the platform now.
What do you think is next for them?
I think one interesting trend is kind of a blending of the traditional and kind of non-traditional digital world. So you're increasingly seeing stars from the digital realm actually pursue traditional media opportunities. But I think it's also going the other direction, and you're actually seeing more traditional stars kind of become more active in the digital world.
Daniel Rosen from Fullscreen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So what's it like to be one of those YouTube stars? Sam Shuey is one of them. He's represented by Fullscreen and tells us more.
Thank you so much for having me.
I guess most people would call you a YouTube star, right?
I suppose. I've gotten that a lot.
How does that feel?
You know, it's bizarre. It didn't really exist, you know, a handful of years ago, and it's cool to have the unique vantage point of being sort of on the front wave of all of this stuff and getting to watch it unfold and develop.
This thing called content.
Content, yeah.
What does that mean?
You know, it applies to so much stuff. It's easy, you know, because it's sort of this new hot idea, YouTube, that everything gets lumped together, you know, and that someone who's making vlogs or someone who's doing music or comedy, it's all, oh, you're all just YouTubers. But it's such a diverse content. It represents such a diverse amount of things. I guess the best way that I could describe it is packets of entertainment that, especially nowadays, people use to kind of describe themselves.
Give us the capsule version of how this started. You were writing songs, you sang a cappella in school. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to now, and you played a sold-out show here in New York. What happened in between?
You know, when I started, I was in college, and at the time, no one was thinking about YouTube stars. No one was saying there are content creators. People weren't, you know, even imagining that you could make a living and create a brand with these new digital kind of tools. And so, yeah, when I started, it was, hey, you know, I'm an artist and always on the lookout for new ways to share my material, and this seems like a cool, interesting way to have a couple people outside of my inner circle watch it. But, you know, as the numbers grew and sort of more outside opportunities began to come in from the viewership, it was kind of a slow realization, okay, this is actually something that can, A, make money, that can, you know, B, continue to grow and kind of, you know, use this digital platform as a base to create a whole brand.
When did Fullscreen get involved?
Fullscreen got involved about a year and a half ago. Much of it is still very small scale, and people would be surprised, you know, that a lot of the decisions, it's still just me, and a lot of the content is pretty much just me recording my own stuff, filming my own stuff. But then, you know, as it grows, there's also things that it's nice to have sort of a bigger organization with some clout and who's specially attuned to kind of the ever-changing winds of this world.
So I watched some of your videos online, and a 30-second ad pops up. Is that how you make the money? Or how else do you make money?
Yeah, that's definitely where some of the money comes from. But the best thing that YouTube does is marketing. And it's kind of a way to grow the brand and get eyeballs. And then where a lot of the rest of the money comes from is using those eyeballs and kind of that relevance. I just did a deal with Canon where I'm using one of their cameras in a couple of my videos and kind of showing it off and showing off the features. I think the most important thing that YouTube does is it's the kind of hub.
One of the things that companies like Fullscreen tout is basically, you know, it's not only eyeballs, but really specific niche level understanding of those eyeballs. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have a granular level understanding of who you're singing to? And does that inform the kind of music that you write?
The amazing thing about anything in the digital space is that you can have access to a lot of analytics, and I know where people are watching my music. That's why I chose to tour in Asia first, because I know I have a large following there, and I can literally pinpoint how many views are from this city, which is fantastic and a great resource to have access to. I mean, I think one of the cool things, too, is that because the content releasing model for a YouTuber is, you know, a lot of content, frequently putting out a video every week, you're able to have a great sort of running sense of what's working and what's not.
How often are you writing and putting things up?
I release about a video a week.
Oh my God.
And, you know, sometimes it's a cover or a mashup or a medley, but more and more it's original stuff. And it's great to have that kind of market analysis to be able to see, okay, this video I posted last week got less views than the video I posted the week before. And, you know, you have comments as well. You obviously have to wade through.
You read the comments?
I do. Oh, certainly. When a new video is posted, I obviously, there's a lot of comments. It is really useful, and not only to see what's working, but it's important to be engaged. That's a huge part of what is attractive to viewers about this new kind of content, is that it is very much a two-way street.
Sam Shuey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to our weekend number, 100. That's the number of hours of video uploaded to YouTube every minute. But if you're waiting for your big break on YouTube, the numbers may not be in your favor. Half of all videos uploaded there have fewer than 500 views. One of the flip sides of consumption is giving. And this season, many of you are buying gifts or donating to charity, helping someone, or someone's helping you. We asked you to share your stories. How do you balance helping others with your personal financial needs? Here are some answers.
I guess I just don't really plan ahead for Christmas shopping, so I end up having to shop last minute and then pay the price by usually spending more than I would like to. If I had planned more, I'd probably spend less.
Christmas budget. Just allocate your money until next year. Then you have your money there. That's to do it, opposed to bam, you know.
For budgeting for Christmas, I try and buy my Christmas presents all year long when sales are going on.
I kind of feel like I should spend more, but I'm just tired. I raised my kids. I used to run around doing the Christmas thing every year since they were little and spending tons of money and a bunch of junk. So I'm kind of glad they're older now. So I tell them, you know what, I've already done the thing. No more Christmas, just a little bit, and that's it.
So the kids don't get nothing. The grandbabies get everything. So basically, whatever they want, they'll get.
I guess I think about it while I'm doing it and kind of kick myself. No, I'm not really budgeting.
I'm not really at all.
I probably spend more than I would like to.
I asked her what she wanted. She said Legos. And she wants the boys' Legos because they're cooler. Just, you know, it's just Legos. It's not that going to cost me that much.
I feel like I don't spend enough.
Well, I'm sure they'll understand because it's hard living in this world today.
I actually have been working 8 days straight now, and I'll have lots of money to spend on them.
It's like you're having your kids all over again, so you try to go all out. You get them things that you weren't able to get for your kids at that time.
If I don't have enough money, then I usually use my artistic abilities.
I'm not really buying a lot of Christmas gifts. My kids are all grown up, and so I'm just going to get them a pool table.
My grandson's one is jerseys, and so those are like $80 a pop or something like that.
To me, I'd like to see the sparkle in their eye when they open the gifts.
I'm just going
to
get everyone what I think they love, so that's it.
It excites me to see them happy, and I love it.
Thanks to all of the people who spoke with us. And we could probably all use some help deciding how, when, or how much to give. So we asked certified financial planner Lise Andriana to join us. She's been in the business for over 2 decades. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you, Lizzie. I'm glad to be here.
I want to start with one of our listeners who wrote us on Facebook, and her name is Rebecca. And one of the things she wrote us is that so that her family isn't spending a lot on the holidays, they've been donating to charities in lieu of purchasing gifts for others. And last year, they adopted some families from a local nonprofit. This year, they'll do something similar. And she said they end up spending about the same amount of money as they would on gifts, but they think they get more out of it. I'm curious what you think about that as a strategy.
I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's a great idea, Lizzie. It serves two functions. Part of being happy in this world is giving back and being grateful. They're helping people who need, and they're making themselves feel better by doing so.
What do you do if you're in the situation, which I think a lot of people are still after the recession, where, look, money's tight and it's hard to figure out where you cut, but you still want maybe the children in your life to have a happy holiday or, you know, have the joy of opening presents. Do you have tips there?
In our financial planning practice, we have a chart for gifting that would break the list of people you're going to be making gifts to into three groups. Primary, so your primary relationships, your secondary relationships, and then service providers and other. So you take your annual budget, which should not exceed 3% of your income. And now I take that and I take a chunk and I allocate it to my primary relationships and decide how much I'm going to spend on each person in advance. I have a smaller amount for my secondary gift list. And then for service providers, of course, you've got the smallest amount.
Do you think it's okay to go into any kind of debt at all? You know, charge some things on the credit card for holiday spending?
Are you going to pay it off in January? If not, I'd say
maybe.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. If you're not sure, then the answer is no, you shouldn't. I mean, I would find another way of gifting.
Yeah, I remember when I was little, my mother used to, I think, appreciate the most when we made gift certificates for things like one breakfast in bed.
Absolutely.
You know, redeemable,
yeah,
whenever.
Yeah, exactly. That's the best. Those are the best.
You have written about the sandwich generation. You wrote a book, Financial Care for Your Aging Parent. Is there special advice for that group about the holidays?
The one thing that caregivers could use is time off. So if they were to ask for something, they should be asking for, could you take grandma shopping? Or could you come and sit at the house while I go shopping or go to a movie? Because they're exhausted. They're at their wit's end, a lot of them, and pressed way beyond the norm. They're putting in a lot of time and effort, and they're receiving no reward for that.
Last week on the show, we talked about how the middle class is often particularly hard hit by, say, Black Friday deals. There's a certain kind of, I guess it's lifestyle spending, where they really get squeezed. Why do you think that is?
On the typical budget, they're spending somewhere between 60 and 70% of their income on the necessities of life. And the other 30, 40% includes things like clothing, things like entertainment. Childcare isn't even in there, and childcare is huge. So that leaves a very small percentage of your income to spend on other things, and that needs to be allocated very carefully. There's a lot of ways to show your love without spending a lot of money. And I want to mention, you know, gifting, it's not a competitive sport. And I think that's where the middle class gets stuck. You know, they think they have to keep up with everybody. But it's not a competitive sport. Just relax. Do what you can afford. And you have to do it from your side of the equation, not trying to please a thousand other people out there.
You've been doing this for 20 years. I'm just curious, you know, when you think back over your career, if there are examples you've seen of people who did this really successfully or, you know, utter disasters.
I think there's a lot of people who struggle with the how much should I give and how much should I spend on myself. Grandparents particularly overspending on children and grandchildren to an excessive amount.
Is there a message that works for grandparents?
Oh, it's not that easy. To be honest, Lizzie, it's very difficult to talk grandparents out of spoiling their grandchildren.
Lee Sandriana is a certified financial planner. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Next week, Marketplace is taking a special look at gentrification and neighborhood transformation. We want to know what that means for your wallet. Maybe higher rent or more kinds of stores. How has your changing neighborhood impacted your personal finances? We want to hear your stories. Tell us by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org, visit Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. As I mentioned, Marketplace is taking an in-depth look at gentrification. Since August, our Wealth and Poverty Desk has been working out of a satellite bureau in the Highland Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. The area, like many neighborhoods nearby, is rapidly gentrifying. Reporter Noelle King joins us to talk about the project and what homes can tell us about a neighborhood's past, present, and future. Hi, Noelle.
Hey, Lizzie.
So you guys did something very unusual. You opened up a bureau, a satellite office, if you will, in the Highland Park neighborhood in Los Angeles.
That's right. You know, we knew we were going to be reporting on this neighborhood in depth, and we thought instead of parachuting in and just spending a few hours a day and a few days a week, why don't we set up an actual shop there? You know, if you're going to go deep into a neighborhood, why not make these people our neighbors? That was our thinking.
So you reported on two specific houses in Highland Park and how they've changed hands over the years. Why go that route?
We wanted to see if what we think we know about gentrification and real estate is actually true. And when we dug into the histories of particular houses, we wanted to know whether we'd find narratives that are the classic kind of gentrification narrative. So the first house I'm profiling is this little two-bedroom bungalow on York Boulevard, which is one of the main thoroughfares. And the owners were a Latino family, the Alvarados, who bought the house way back in 1978 for about $78,000. Then when they went to sell a year ago, the house sold for $521,000, which is so much more money, 1,200 square feet, so much more money than they ever expected to earn on that property. And that is one of your classic gentrification narratives, right? A family buys low when the neighborhood is a rough place and then makes out when the changes come.
So, you know, they sold high, but that also means that somebody is buying pretty high.
It sure does. The young couple that bought the Alvarado's house on York, they've spent more than $500,000 for this house, right? It's a house where they're still doing loads of renovations. They're doing the walls, they're doing the ceilings, they're living in the basement in the meantime. That's how much work they're doing. And when I asked them, you know, why didn't you just spend that money, $500,000, on one of the houses that's already been flipped and rehabbed? And here's what the owner, Katie Dormeyer, had to say.
A lot of the places that were flipped that we did visit, they were done inexpensively or so magnificently that we couldn't afford them. And a lot of these houses, we felt like they were soulless.
So you have this young couple moving in. They are clearly changing the culture of the neighborhood. And that's, I guess, one of the narratives of gentrification.
So the tension starts when, you know, there's a feeling that this was our place, this was our neighborhood. Back in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, when no one cared about it, we were the people who were sticking it out, who had the restaurants and the small businesses, the mom and pop shops. And now you guys are coming in and you're remaking the neighborhood to fit your taste. You're opening up wine bars, you're opening up vegan restaurants. That's not for us, that's for you. And so you do have this kind of culture clash. Some people who've been in the neighborhood for decades love it. I should say that right off the bat. But not everybody. For some people, it really feels a little bit like you guys are invading our turf.
That produces all sorts of feelings and a lot of that awkwardness, which I think often goes unspoken when you talk about gentrification, but you guys bring it out in the open in your stories.
That's right. The second house I profiled, I actually had the man who recently bought the house speak to the former owner, and they had a great conversation about, is he a gentrifier? And this woman who sold him the house was an artist. Was she a gentrifier back in the 90s when she bought the house? She was a white artist with some extra money. So the second house, I should say, is this little white stucco box. It's a two-bedroom, two-bath house that sold for $710,000. The man who bought it, Paul Downer, he's a pattern drafter from San Francisco. And in this scenario, right, Lizzie, he is your classic gentrifier. He's bringing money into the neighborhood. But when I asked him, do you think, Paul, that you're a gentrifier? He said, no, absolutely not. And he actually had this really funny moment where he was telling me what he thinks of this very kind of exclusive restaurant scene that's popping up on York Boulevard in Highland Park.
A lot of the cafes, I feel like unworthy of walking in because the waiters seem much more hipper and interesting than I am. And I'm like intimidated. And I some of the things on the menu I've never heard of before. And I'm from San Francisco. I'm not from, you know, someplace, you know, that basic.
In these conversations you were having with people, do you think the word gentrification or gentrifier is just toxic?
When I was first speaking to people, when I was first trying to see if they were interested in participating in this project, I often wouldn't use the word gentrification. I would say transformation. I would say change. I would say evolution. I would use any word but the G word. Some people actually wouldn't physically say the word. They would say the G word or they would use one of the synonyms. But the word gentrification was just too embarrassing, too awkward, too painful for people to say.
Noelle King from our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thank you so much, Noelle.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
Listen to Marketplace all next week for more on gentrification and the Highland Park Bureau. Here's a story about a vast market and narrow consumption. Last time you looked at your smartphone, were you faced with a sea of icons? And did you wonder why you downloaded so many apps but seemed to actually use so few? The makers of smartphone apps from all over the world came to London recently for the Apps World Conference. And the BBC's Robert Champion went along to ask software developers if we've already reached peak app.
If you want to comb your cat, there's an app for that. If you have to fix a flat, there's an app for that. Need a word that rhymes with that?
There seems to be an app for just about everything. The numbers tell the story. In Apple's store, for example, there's over 1 million apps. 6 years ago, there were just 800. Who's making them all then? Well, I've been speaking to software developers at Apps World in London's Excel Centre, where they'd brought along a touch of Silicon Valley, a crazy golf course, foosball, and, naturally, table tennis.
I'm Sarah Stocker. I'm the co-founder of Wearlinx. We're actually hosting the first of its kind event. We're going to give everyone in the game a Pebble smartwatch to wear, and they're going to run around and use geolocation to tag an area for their team. And the team with the greatest area at the end of the game in 10 minutes wins the game. Okay, you guys ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
One, two, three, go!
There's an app for that.
But it's not all about fun and games. The opportunity to network and find new customers and investors is high up on the agenda.
The name is Leke. I'm actually the CEO of Signtech Paperless Solutions. I've been here for 2 days, and it's quite interesting the amount of people who just come around. I think one of the managing directors at Telefonica, for example, come to speak to us. We had a few people from Neopost who actually walked past, and we've now got a few leads, a few meetings we now have to attend next week.
We're talking to lots of software developers, and I'm thinking, is it possible we've reached a point where we've reached peak app? Like we've reached peak oil, perhaps.
It is so easy to develop an app. The market is definitely being flooded, and almost anyone can develop an app.
I mean, not from Epoxy. I'm the head of customer success. Everything is being recycled today, you know. It's all about doing it a bit different. I can have a business that does something very similar to the next door neighbor, but I'll do it a bit different, so I might get a different target audience.
I'm Amanda, and I'm from OneSky.
Could it be that we've reached a point where we've reached peak app? Can we create any more?
I think there are still a lot of rooms for new apps coming out because our needs are always like changing. I think like humans are like greedy. When you got one stuff, you always want like better solution.
My name is Yair, I'm from Test Ferry. I see every day new apps that are innovative, that solve real problems. There are apps out there that are useless for some people and fun for others. But there are still lots of problems in this world that needs to be solved.
Walking around the hall, I noticed another growth area. Apps which enhance other apps, offering tools for developers to find out what their customers like, what marketing tactics to use, and how to generate revenue from advertising. One such service is called App Annie. I asked Vice President Marcos Sanchez whether his analysis of the latest trends points to a day when we could see peak app.
I think that, yes, very obviously there are 7 digits to a phone number because we remember 7 digits. There will be a number of apps that we probably don't exceed much. What I suspect will really happen is there will be 5 to 10 apps that you just rely on. And then you'll have a rotation of the rest of them. And depending probably on where you are in the spectrum of tech adoption, your rotation might be as much as 150 or 200, or your rotation might be 20, 30, 40.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's an app, there's an app, there's an app for that!
That story came to us from our partners at the BBC. And that's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ravi Karman is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll hear your stories about how gentrification affects your finances. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. This is APM.